The months passed at a breathless pace, with constant reminders of all the things left undone. We worked with a citywide coalition in support of school reform. We held a series of joint meetings with Mexicans in the southeast side to craft a common environmental strategy for the region. I drove Johnny nuts, trying to cram him with the things that had taken me 3 years to learn. In February, I received my acceptance from Harvard Law School. The letter came with a thick packet of information. It reminded me of the packet I'd received from Punahou that summer 14 years earlier. I remembered how Gramps had stayed up the whole night, reading from the catalog about music lessons and advanced placement courses, glee clubs and baccalaureates, how he had waved the catalog and told me it would be my meal ticket, that the contacts I'd made at a school like Punahou would last me a lifetime, that I would move in charmed circles and have all the opportunities that he had never had. I remember how, at the end of the evening, he had smiled and tussled my hair, his breath smelling of whiskey, his eyes shining as if we were about to cry. And I had smiled back at him, pretending to understand, but actually wishing I was still in Indonesia, running barefoot along a paddy field, with my feet sinking in the cool, wet mud, part of a chain of other brown boys chasing after a tattered kite. I felt something like that now. I had scheduled a luncheon that week at our office for the 20 or so ministers whose churches had agreed to join the organization. Most of the ministers we'd invited showed up, as did most of our key leadership. Together we discussed strategies for the coming year. We set dates for a training retreat, agreed on a schedule of dues, talked about the continued need to recruit more churches. When we were finally finished, I announced that I'd be leaving in May and that Johnny would be taking over as director. That Sunday, I woke up at 6 a.m. I shaved, brushed the lint from my only suit, and arrived at the church by 7:30. Most of the pews were already filled. A white-gloved usher led me past elderly matrons in wide plumaged hats, tall, unsmiling men in suits and ties and mud-cloth kufis, children in their Sunday best. I shunted through to the center of a row and stuffed myself between a plump older woman who failed to scoot over and a young family of four, the father already sweating in his coarse woolen jacket, the mother telling the two young boys beside her to stop kicking each other. "Where's God?" I overheard the toddler ask his brother. "Shut up," the older boy replied. "Both of you settle down right now," the mother said. As the congregation joined in song, the deacons, then Reverend Wright, appeared beneath the large cross that hung from the rafters. The Reverend remained silent while devotions were read, scanning the faces in front of him, watching the collection basket pass from hand to hand. When the collection was over, he stepped up to the pulpit and read the names of those who had passed away that week, those who were ailing, each name causing a flutter somewhere in the crowd, the murmur of recognition. "Let us join hands," the Reverend said, "as we kneel and pray at the foot of an old rugged cross. Yes. Lord, we come first to thank you for what you've already done for us. We come to thank you most of all for Jesus. Lord, we come from different walks of life, some considered high and some low, but all on equal ground at the foot of this cross. Lord, thank you. For Jesus, Lord, our burden bearer and heavy load share, we thank you." The title of Reverend Wright's sermon that morning was The Audacity of Hope. He began with a passage from the book of Samuel, the story of Hannah, who, barren and taunted by her rivals, had wept and shaken in prayer before her God. The story reminded him, Reverend Wright said, of a sermon a fellow pastor had preached at a conference some years before, in which the pastor described going to a museum and being confronted by a painting titled Hope. "The painting depicts a harpist," Reverend Wright explained, "a woman who at first glance appears to be sitting atop a great mountain, until you take a closer look and see that the woman is bruised and bloodied, dressed in tattered rags, the harp reduced to a single frayed string. Your eye is then drawn down to the scene below, down to the valley below, where everywhere are the ravages of famine, the drumbeat of war, a world groaning under strife and deprivation. It is this world, a world where cruise ships throw away more food in a day than most residents of Port-au-Prince see in a year, where white folks' greed runs a world in need, apartheid in one hemisphere, apathy in another hemisphere. That's the world on which hope sits."